Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Trina. Thanks so much for joining me. This week's show, we have two guests for you. First up, you'll hear from newly retired football player Chris Long, who also, for the past 6 weeks, has written recaps for Game of Thrones for SI.com, and they have been edited by yours truly. So we'll talk to Chris about his writing career, Game of Thrones, and hanging it up and calling it quits for his very, very successful NFL career. And then after that, you're going to hear from my SI colleague, Grant Wall, who's getting ready to cover the Women's World Cup in early June. Grant, a longtime veteran at SI, does it all. Also does TV work for Fox, and he's part of a new podcast here at SI called Throwback. And it, the first season of it covers the 1991 Women's World Cup team and tells a very interesting story there. And Grant gets into all that. He hosts that podcast. So Chris Long, Grant Wall, right here on this episode of the SI Media Podcast. Quick plug here for the archives. Please, if you haven't listened to past episodes, check them out. Last week was a good one. Chad Finn from the Boston Globe on sports media news, and Brian Curtis, who wrote a great article about broadcasters, sports broadcasters who love Howard Stern. That was, if you're a Stern fan and you haven't checked that out, because I know a lot of you, I have a lot of Stern fans who follow me on Twitter, so if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to it, give it a listen. It was interesting. And then also in the archives, NFL Insider Ian Rappaport, ESPN's Mike Breen, who's going to call the Warriors winning the NBA Finals in the next several days. Jim Nance is in the archives as well. So give it all a listen. Subscribe, rate, review. It helps tremendously. The plugs are over, and now we get to Chris Long. All right, joining me now, a man in several transitions. He's no longer an NFL player. He's no longer an SI.com writer. And I'm kind of sad about that. Chris Long, who has been writing Game of Thrones recaps for SI and just announced his retirement from the NFL after winning two Super Bowls. What's up, Chris?
Dude, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. We've been bonded together over these 6 weeks. I want people to understand how hard you worked on these columns each and every week.
Well, I mean, the retirement, I thought, would take the pressure off my SI now retirement.
Right.
So I just tried to put that right ahead of my last column. But, I mean, it's been fun, man. I really enjoy writing, and I enjoy the show. I'll never claim to be, like, one of those, you know, books fanatics. I've tried to write those columns from a standpoint of an educated fan who doesn't take any of it too seriously. I mean, you know, it's been there's been moments of absolute hysteria among the fan base in the past 6 to 8 weeks. So I've tried to stay on the fringes and try to give as balanced an opinion as I could on it.
Just for background, if anyone's listening to this wanting to hear Chris Long talk about football and they don't know what's going on about Thrones, so obviously, you know, everyone knew this was the final season of Game of Thrones, monstrous, cultural, iconic show, and I wanted to get an athlete to sort of write about it, and it's a tough deal because, you know, it's a Sunday night show, you want someone to write on Monday, so that sort of eliminates, like, MLB players who watch the show, but I knew Chris was a very intelligent, capable individual who watched the show. So I reached out to him with the offer. You said yes fairly quickly. And I knew.
I do that a lot. I do that a lot accidentally. And there were a few moments where I was like, fuck, yeah. Did I say yes to this?
Yeah.
This is a tough undertaking. I mean, having nothing to do with what y'all asked me to do. I mean, I think initially when you asked me to write about the recaps, you probably envision short form, quick hitting, humorous stuff, but I can't analyze anything without, like, nuance,
right?
Especially a show that's that watched, and something that, like, you know, in the last season, these are 80 to 90 minute
episodes.
Yeah. And there's so many plot lines, you know, it's not like a Breaking Bad where you'd spend an hour and Walter's in the basement cooking meth, and there's, you know, minutia within that long-ass scene. But, you know, it's one scene. These are episodes now where they're trying to cram multiple plot lines into 60 to 80 minute periods. So it was challenging, but I really had fun with it. It challenged me as a writer. I've always enjoyed writing, and I look forward to doing more of it when I retire. But yeah, I definitely, I guess you kind of made it seem like you knew I was the guy to ask because I'm a total loser and I had nothing going on.
No, it had it had nothing to do with that. I've interviewed you before. I follow you on Twitter. I've seen your interviews. I just knew you'd be the right fit for this, and I knew you would be very thorough about it, but I did not think you'd be as thorough as you were, which I totally respected and was really in awe of. And it was, you know.
Well, I got a bit of a problem. I do. It's hard for me to just quick hit almost anything,
right. But I never pitch quick hits. I said, do it as long or as short as you want, however you want.
Yep.
You know, I sort of left it up to you. I do think, and I think we worked well together, but I do think you definitely lost a little respect for me when I broke the news to you that I don't watch Thrones. I just knew you'd be the guy to write about it.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it made it, because sometimes when you finish watching the show, when I watch the show, I'm baked when I watch the show. I mean, like, half of America is probably high watching Game of Thrones. So it's hard to take the notes and do the things that you need to do. But I do, and I've got these scribbly notepads that I'm just jotting the entire time, and my wife is pissed because I'm, like, pausing it. And I probably ruined the enjoyment of the season for her. But she didn't like it that much anyways. But then, you know, what I found in rewatching a lot of these episodes, which I didn't do the first seven seasons, was that a lot of times I had two different, completely different takeaways and two different opinions of episodes respectively. So it was good for me because I feel like I know the last season in and out. Probably the wrong season to know in and out.
Right. Well, there's only six episodes, though.
But it was fun and it was challenging.
Yeah. Well, you did a tremendous. I kissed your ass every week. You did a tremendous job. And
well, I appreciate that.
And I wasn't trying to blow smoke up your ass. You really did a
great
job. You
got to keep the interns happy. So I appreciate you. You stroking the ego I enjoyed it. It was definitely a fun ride.
That's how good of a guy Chris is. He did this for free. Now, listen, the guy gave up his salary for an NFL season, so doing this for free probably wasn't as damaging as that, but that's how good of a guy.
That you mention it, it's kind of the principle. I feel like I'm waiting on a check.
Believe me, what SI pays, you won't be able to do much with.
I'm not the only one.
Yeah. So let's talk about Thrones just for a little bit, even though I didn't watch it, but I sort of feel like I know stuff now just from editing your column. I give you credit because, you know, in this Twitter age where there's instant reaction and you have to fly off the handle at everything, you really try to, I think, stay level-headed throughout. And for me, as someone who doesn't watch it, I would scroll through Twitter on a Sunday night and I'd see all these people bashing the show. And then you would come out with your column on Monday and sort of have a different perspective on it, which I thought was very interesting. Do you have to, like, consciously not be swayed by public opinion? Are you very strong in that this is what you thought of the show? You're not going to let these people, or because it also could go the other way where you're like, oh, maybe this person has a point. Maybe I'm seeing, especially a show like that that's so intricate with so many details.
Yeah. Yeah, it's easy to be swayed on social media in general, and I think that's what social media is largely about in a lot of ways is, you know, you get this mass of opinion, and if, you know, most of the opinions on your timeline align, you know, it's human nature to be swayed, and I am somebody who's impressionable and I can be influenced, but at the same time, I enjoyed the challenge of, like, listen, reading some takes from some of my peers who I generally agree with on a lot of stuff, and it's easy to get influenced by them. and then throwing them out and be like, you know what? I think this take is dog shit, and I'm going to write the opposite. And right. I think what I found was that there were two episodes that were really challenging for me. Actually, there were three. I mean, they were all challenging, but episode three, Battle of Winterfell, you know, you had a lot of people initially when I opened my timeline that were kind of heralding this episode as one of the best of all times. And obviously that was a knee-jerk reaction by some people, but I saw a lot of flaws, and I actually watched it with a former teammate, Bo Allen, in Las Vegas, and that was a real challenge in and of itself, writing a column in Vegas in a hotel room. Yeah. But I was like, I gotta stay down the middle on this thing. I gotta be ready to take the backlash. And what you find is that, like, when you fire your take off, that there's a lot of people, like moth to a light, that are gonna see your take, and they were afraid to share it, and they're excited that somebody else had it. I think five and six were challenging because I thought five was completely getting shit on unnecessarily in a lot of ways, and it was largely because of the Danny decision, and you know, we can get into that, but episode six was also difficult because I was just at some points just laughably, I mean, like it was really bad at some points my first watch, and then I get online and I'm seeing that there is a mixed bag of reactions, and I obviously rewatch it, and like much of the season, I realized that it was just an inconsistent episode. Very inconsistent, but to not get swayed is a challenge. And I do read a lot of tweets, because we do pull tweets to put into these columns. So it's easy to get influenced, but you got to fight it off. You got to fight the urge.
Well, and I think one of the many things that sucks about Twitter and just the time we live in now is if you do have a contrarian opinion that you actually believe, where, I mean, in episode five, for instance, there are people saying it was the worst episode of all time, where, you know, and you felt strongly that it wasn't the case. And now it's like, if you go out, if you have the opposite take of the majority, then you get killed for people saying, like, you're making it up to be, you know, I get, like, just to throw this out there, I am one of the few people, like, I liked the Seinfeld finale. Like, everybody hated it. I liked it.
I don't even know what happened there.
They brought back all of the, like, fringe characters that the core group of Jerry and Elaine and Kramer and George sort of screwed over in some way throughout the series. And there was a trial. Yeah. It started where some big fat guy got mugged and they didn't do anything. They laughed and then they got arrested. And then they ended up in jail. I don't know. Anyway, I want to
give Seinfeld a chance because I know you're like a big Seinfeld fan.
Yes.
And I never really gave it a chance, but I keep hearing the two finales that everybody talked about is Lost and Seinfeld, and a little bit of Sopranos, but that was very subjective. So I thought there were a lot of people that liked that ending. So yeah, it's tough. It's tough to wrap a series, especially when that all eyes are on that series. Can you imagine? I mean, I guess Jimmy, could you imagine what Seinfeld would have endured in the age of Twitter or any of these shows? A lot of these shows that got to run in the 90s and even in the early 2000s, they had the kind of freedom to evolve and make mistakes. And the only way that everybody was going to hear about it if they didn't pick it up on screen was, you know, Entertainment Weekly or some shit. But now we're inundated with this pressure to think how everybody else is thinking about the episodes and about the art.
Exactly. But we're also at this point now, and I feel like it mirrors like the political climate. It's like, you can't say something different. Like, when the Seinfeld finale happened, you could have said, now, while most people trashed it and thought it stunk, if you said you liked it, you wouldn't have gotten, you know, scoffed at and acted like you were just saying something to be contrarian and to get attention. Now, if you say something, if you say it, it's like, oh, you just want attention. You're just being contrarian, hot take, blah, blah. But if you might really feel that way, really felt like episode five was a mixed bag. You didn't think it was all bad while everyone else was trashing it to no end.
And another thing is this. I mean, like, I kind of did my own psychological study where I would ask as many people in person. I was asking people at the grocery store, like, you know, on a Monday, like, hey, what'd you think about the episode last night? Right. Like, you know, like, fucking, I'm grabbing broccoli and putting it in a bag, and there's like a 60-year-old woman next to me, and she's like, how's your day going? I'm like, oh, I'm tired from Game of Thrones. Yeah. I try to like bring it up to see, I was up late watching Game of Thrones, and then if she, you know, bit and she was into having that conversation, I want to go down that road.
Right.
And I'd ask my friends, and I'd ask people I like and I know are intelligent and critical. And what I found was that generally people in person are not as critical as they are on Twitter. Right. And I think that's for a few reasons. I think Twitter is, you know, I hate saying it because some people I really disagree with call it an echo chamber, but it is an echo chamber in a lot of ways, no matter what you believe in any arena of thought. And then secondly, I think the type of person that's going to have a Twitter account is somebody who's very analytical. And somebody who's going to be active in an online community is going to be very analytical and by nature kind of critical. And I'm no exception, right? So I'm not shitting on the type of people that are on Twitter, but Twitter is not reality.
Right.
And, you know, there are a lot of people who have no idea what's going on Twitter on a daily basis. So they digest Game of Thrones very individually.
I just thought of another one. Did you see the Queen movie a few months ago?
I got through 10 minutes of it, I just did not dig the tone.
Okay. See, I went to the movies. I saw it. I love Queen. Love all their music. I love the movie. I was for 2 hours, I was entertained. I never checked. Like, when I go to the movies, like, you know, that sort of, like, ADD thing kicks in. I'm checking my watch every 5 minutes. I didn't check my watch. I sat through it, enjoyed it, was happy, left there happy, loved the music. And then you go on Twitter, and I said I liked it, and people just destroyed me.
People crush you. I mean, and like, listen, if there's some reason that a movie's historically inaccurate or problematic in some way where it's like painting a character who is a real shitbag as a good person or vice versa,
right?
You know, and I'm fine with people taking issue with the objective facts. But when you're talking about an art form and like something that's very subjective, I think you just have to, you can definitely like, there's a difference between like vehemently disagreeing with somebody that you obviously are like cool with and you're like, after this conversation we're cool, but there's a lot of people who just want you to agree with them so bad that you're an enemy if they don't, and it happens with TV shows.
And I thought you did a really nice job explaining this in the finale column that's on SI.com right now about the last episode, in that also, I go see this Queen movie, I come out, I love it, and then people are talking about the inaccuracies, and they didn't show this, and they didn't show this, and this was, but then when you take a step back, and this is what you did, I think, it's a movie. Game of Thrones is a TV show. You don't have to, you know, it's okay if there's a couple of things here and there that are amiss. It's not going to destroy anyone's life, and while the Thrones fans were passionate about it, I think you really explained it nicely in the last column about, you know, okay, the finale was rough, the last season was rough, but we had 8 years of the show that we constantly talked about, and you explained that well, I thought.
Yeah. I mean, like, listen, we all have equity in the show on some level if you've watched it, and whether you've got a season or two or you binged it and you have equity that way, or you watched it for 8 years, or you bought merchandise, or you read all the books, like, there's different levels to it, but it's not yours, and it's not your life. It's a show, and, you know, I was disappointed by the season largely, but also you have to have the perspective of like, listen, are you glad Game of Thrones existed or are you not? And like, we can have a critical discussion, but like, let's not overreact, and there's a difference between like disappointment and like being indignant and being just like, I was owed better.
Right.
Like, you're not owed anything. Like, you know, I think Sansa Stark's actress, Sophie Turner, she came out and said something recently that we referenced in the column, which was that, like, it's kind of disrespectful to all the people that worked really hard for a long time. And I mostly feel this for the actors and actresses, the performers. And listen, the writers, the direction that the writers drove the show in the absence of very specific George R. R. Martin waypoints. If you're disappointed in that, that's very fair game. But the performances were stellar. And so, like, when you're going to call for a remake of the season and you're going to be very critical, just keep in mind that a lot of people put their heart into that. And I thought that somebody like Sophie Turner has a legitimate gripe when it comes to the actors and actresses, because if there was anything that show was really consistently good at was the portrayal of these characters, whether or not you liked the direction that they were headed at the hands of the showrunners as of late.
It's interesting, too, because I don't even know if you watch it. I don't think we ever discussed it. But the week before the Game of Thrones finale, HBO had the Veep finale, and that was universally praised. I feel like almost the expectations for the Game of Thrones finale were too high, and they were never going to be able to get met anyway.
Expectations matter. They yeah, matter.
Absolutely.
They always matter for me in movies. Like,
yeah,
you know, when I watch a movie, like, there's a few movies I just hate. And, like, I think I don't like them anyways.
Give me a couple.
I think I wouldn't like them.
Give me a couple.
I wouldn't like... Well, okay, so here's a perfect one. I really did not enjoy Three Billboards.
Interesting.
I couldn't stand it. It reads like a play, and I know it was written by a playwright, but I'm not into, like, this, like... It's almost like half the people in that movie are talking to the audience member, not to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big pet peeve of mine. And there were a lot of, it was corny to me. And,
right. And
you know, when you walk into a movie that everybody's like, this is a knockout movie, you're always going to be expecting a lot.
Right.
And I don't think that was one of them. Another one that I didn't like was the movie, with the two bank robbers and Jeff Bridges in Texas.
Oh, yeah, I know. That
I conveniently forgot the name of the movie. But
I know what you're talking about.
And pretty much every Jeff Bridges movie I love. I didn't enjoy that movie
right.
at all. I thought it was, like, grossly overrated. But these are both movies that I walked into in recent memory, and I had high expectations for it. Did it play a role in my disdain for the movies? Probably.
Right.
But, you know.
We got to talk football for a minute. Before we get to football, very quick, give me, and I know you don't like doing this. This was like anti-Chris Long when we were writing these columns, but I'm going to ask you to do it. Give me what grade you would give the final season, a grade, and then tell me what show you're going to tackle next.
Well, so, I mean, when you're grading, you have to take into account, is it relative or is it not? Like, when I get on Rotten Tomatoes and they grade.
I would say, I would do it this way.
Go ahead.
Your enjoyment level of season six was a B,
C plus. See, here was the problem. You grade an episode in a vacuum.
Right.
And like an episode, like episode five is great in a vacuum. I mean, it's wildly entertaining, some really good CGI, great acting. There's some plot holes that you wouldn't know unless you watched the show. And another thing, you know, is these episodes individually are victims of being a part of season eight.
Right.
And season eight is a victim of being a part of the expectation of being one of the greatest franchises of all time and wrapping it without George R. R. Martin's, you know, kind of training wheels. So I would look at it as like, listen, if I'm grading it on a scale of Game of Thrones, it's a C-.
Okay.
You know, and that's low because all the other ones are pretty damn good. If I'm grading it on a scale of like other shows, like, listen, there are some episodes. I used to love The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
When that second wave of characters came in, the show just, it was like a nosedive.
Right.
You're going to tell me that 49% episode five on Rotten Tomatoes is worse than a lot of those average Walking
right.
Dead episodes, like in the twilight of the show.
Right. Right.
And for me, like, the twilight started like five seasons in, but
yeah.
So I guess C- on a scale of Game of Thrones and on a scale of like regular TV, it's a B.
Right.
And
fair.
As far as like the next show I'd tackle, I haven't gotten into Mad Men.
Oh, it's great. It's great. And they had a good finale. I'll tell you that. No spoilers, but
okay.
It was a good finale. Mad Men was great.
Well,
but if you haven't watched Seinfeld, I mean, you got to get on that. I mean, that's ridiculous.
I think Seinfeld, I've watched Seinfeld, but I've never like religiously watched it. I like to get into Mad Men. As you know, my schedule's kind of cleared up.
Yep.
So I look forward to binging a lot of stuff. But you know, I also, now that I'm unemployed and I'm sitting at home with two young kids, it's not like I can be like, hey, babe, I got to go
right
in the other room and watch Mad Men for 12 hours.
Right. Well, that's why Seinfeld will be a quicker watch. So speaking of all that, was the decision to retire difficult, or were you at peace with it for a while?
You know, it was very difficult. It's always been difficult thinking about, like, I'm somebody who's always thinking ahead, right. And it's hard for me to live in the moment. My entire career, I've been afraid of the day it would end. And, you know, not because I've always, like, been obsessed with football or my identity as a football player, but, like, the what's next and, you know, the existential crisis that I see a lot of guys struggle with when they get out. But as my career has gone on and I've gotten involved with more stuff and kind of, you know, also obviously winning helped finally in my career. I became more at peace with my career. And, you know, although I had a ton of individual success in St. Louis on bad teams, I never felt like my career was successful. And it was something I was very insecure about was, you know, for 8 years, you know, when I'm having a double digit sack season here or there, or, you know, I'm a captain or whatever, all that good shit that you should be excited about, I never felt fulfilled because we weren't winning. And I thought that, I was like, this is going to be my career's a disappointment. Right. And, you know, and when I got IR'd 2 years in a row, I was like, damn, this sucks. I worked my whole life for this. And I guess you can't feel sorry for yourself. I made a lot of money and most people would kill to do this. But for me, this is disappointing. And, you know, to the past couple of years, you know, win a couple Super Bowls and enjoy kind of what it feels like to be a part of a buzz in a city. I felt more at peace with the possibility. And my last 2 years, I hated a lot about pro football. Even though I was winning and on winning teams, I grew tired of certain things Monday through Saturday. And, you know, I love Sunday. I always have. I live to play a game. I live to compete and bust my ass. And just those big plays you have a chance to be a part of, they make your career, and they really, those are memories that will last forever. But, you know, as I was getting ready to go back to Philly this year, it became pretty apparent to me that I wasn't going to have an opportunity to make those plays on Sunday.
Right.
And I'm never somebody who's like, I want to be a pro football player to just put on a uniform and be, quote unquote, the man. You know, if I'm able to do what I love, it's not worth it to me.
Right.
It's too much out of your body. It's too much time away from your family. And I'm healthy. I had a good year last year. I always wanted to go out when they weren't ushering me out, which very few guys get to do that. So I'm blessed, man. I'm excited about the next chapter.
Yeah, it does.
I love my life.
It does seem like if you're an NFL player, you can't go 99%. It's got to be 100%. Now, but the one thing is, now listen, you guys have completely different lifestyles because you have two kids and he's there just, you know, having fun 24/7. But the minute Gronk retired, 5 minutes later, he was talking about possibly coming back if a team needed him. Is that in your head at all, or are you 100% done?
Here's the thing. When I said I'm done, I'm done. And, you know, like, I told Philly something happens. That's where I wanted to retire. If some crazy shit happens and they need me, call me. But I don't anticipate it. That's not something I root for. I want to be done. I've given everything I had to the game for 11 years. Anybody who played with me will tell you I work my ass off. I love being a teammate. And, I enjoyed the locker room, and I tried to make younger players better. And, you know, listen, I'm at peace with it. So at the end of the day, there's things I'm excited about. But what played into it in a big way for me is, like, I could have gotten more jobs. Like, I'm not being arrogant or anything.
No.
I'm just being realistic.
Yeah,
there were jobs I could have had. But, like, for me, I like Philly a whole bunch. And I felt at home there for the first time in a long time. And, you know, for me to have that home when, like, the place I played for 8 years, the franchise, you know, got up and left, like, there's not somewhere I can come back to and watch a game, nothing like that. We're a part of history in Philly forever. So we'll always be the first one.
Right.
No matter how many those guys win. And that's a pretty empowering feeling. I didn't want to want to risk leaving to what, play another 1 or 2 years, break my body more. And, you know, I go play in some weird city. I get carted off the third week. You know, my leg snaps in half. Oof. Nobody gives a shit.
Right. Right.
At least they would cheer for me in Philly.
Right. That is true. That is true. And I know you can't give a ton of details yet, but no one has to worry about missing Chris Long, because he's gonna become a media mogul with podcasts and videos and everything coming up soon. So keep an eye on that.
Yeah. I'm excited about that. We got I've been working on building this digital media company out, carrying content across a lot of different platforms. You know, I'm excited about that. I think football is awesome, but it also kind of crushes your creativity sometimes. It's
right.
not this, a sport where you can be really creative. I mean, you're creative in your craft, but I love building things, and I love developing things, and I enjoy writing. I can't wait to have my pod. I'm working on a conversational type of studio show where I'm going to have guests and whatnot. So, and I look forward to empowering other athletes who are not chasing a brand or trying to fit in, and giving them opportunities to produce things to contribute. And I'm just psyched about it, man. I mean, it gives me something to wake up to every day and have something where I feel like I have to take ownership over it.
Yeah,
you know, I could have got a job maybe somewhere, but I wanted to build something.
Yeah, I know SI wants to hire you badly, but I'm very happy for you. I think that's going to be awesome, and you'll be a great pod host. So I'm looking forward to that. And
you got to come on, man.
Anytime. And I appreciate you coming on my podcast and doing the Thrones. I had a lot of fun. I'll be sad next Monday, but it was a good ride. And
man. You know what? Maybe we can do another show. We can collaborate on something. And the cool thing about it is, like, starting my own company, I don't have to meet any deadlines.
Exactly. Exactly.
Not that I met any deadlines.
You were right. It was fine.
You should have just made it Tuesday.
I should have. But listen, it worked out. And I appreciate you doing it. And great job. I know the fans loved it. So thanks for doing that. Thanks for coming on. And best of luck post NFL.
Thanks a lot, Jimmy. Appreciate it, man. Enjoyed it.
Take care. Be well. All right. My thanks to Chris Long. You're going to hear a quick word here now from the SI Media Podcast sponsor, and then we'll get to Grant Wall from SI. All right. Joining me now, one of my SI colleagues for a long time. Well, I feel like we're like old school SI people.
We count, I think.
SI senior writer Grant Wall, more than a writer though, he's all over the place with podcasts and SI TV stuff, and obviously you got the Women's World Cup coming up, so this is sort of a this is like your time right now to shine.
And I know it is. I know you're not a huge soccer guy, so I'm excited to be on your show. But I also, we have a very big tent in the soccer world.
Right.
And so we're not going to be like those people who like were fans of a band when they were small and then it got bigger.
Right.
And we're like, we don't want you guys. Like, we want you to watch the Women's
World
Cup.
The soccer thing is fascinating in that, well, I guess, the NHL people are sort of like this too, in that they get offended if people don't watch, it seems like. Are you one of those people who get offended if people? Because
no.
Sometimes people just, I mean, for I'll just speak for myself. I don't watch every sport. I mean, I used to watch so much more sports when I was younger.
Right.
But then you get older and real life happens. And you can't watch baseball, the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, college football. I mean, there's just so much of it. And then once you, I think there's a few things that have happened. Obviously, the internet and social media has changed the way we consume things. And then you get older and real life comes in and you have kids and family responsibilities. So it's not like I hate soccer type of thing. It's just like one of those things I don't watch. And, you know, now on the flip side of that, I'll admit it and, you know, I'll watch the WWE, for instance. But I don't get mad if people don't watch the WWE. So I don't understand how hockey people get mad if you don't watch the NHL. Soccer people don't get mad if you don't watch soccer.
I don't care. If somebody doesn't want to watch soccer, that's fine with me. You know, I guess I would also say I'm not like one of those like please like my sport type people.
Right. There's a lot of that, I think, in soccer and hockey, it seems like.
Yeah. I feel like I enjoy it. There's actually quite a few folks in the U.S. now who seem to, and there's like soccer's become one of the best sports, or U.S. has become one of the best countries in the world to watch soccer in. Right. There's a lot on TV now.
It's amazing how much is good. On TV. And it's, you know, if I was younger, I probably would be a soccer fan just based on the fact that there are so many games during the day. And I like to place a wager, and it's a good way to, like, kill time during the day, especially at work. During the, like, weekday games are, like, a good thing. You know, people get excited for day baseball and, you know, when the NFL has those, like, 9 o'clock random something. Anything that's, like, different with the schedule. So, like, I think, I mean, soccer's on here in the office, seems like, every day.
I mean, the volume's insane, and that's why the true degenerate gamblers of the world are probably 95% soccer fans, I would think. Right.
I didn't even think of getting into this, but I'm glad you brought that up. With the gambling bill getting passed, it's been a year now since they passed that. Has that impacted soccer at all? Do you see it impacting soccer down the road? I know these guys out here, Kevin Driscoll, our social media guy, he loves betting the soccer and Skip, our other social media guy. I don't think they should be doing it based on the results, but they love doing it.
I think it's probably a good thing for soccer in America, as with other sports too. Mm-hmm. But for MLS, here's what's interesting about betting, and I don't bet, but like MLS, my sense is at first I'm like, I don't know how anyone could win money consistently betting on MLS, because it's like weird stuff happens in this league. The worst team in the league, Colorado, just beat the LA Galaxy on the weekend, and strange stuff happens. Mm-hmm. But then people who I know are telling me that actually the line setters for MLS aren't very good, and that you can actually, if you know something about MLS, do
That's
better than the guy setting the lines.
That's interesting, because I had a friend of mine use that same philosophy several years ago in betting the WNBA.
Wow.
He would actually follow it, and the people making the lines had no clue what they were doing, and he was able to actually clean up doing that. So it's interesting. I could see that in the MLS. Again, not a monster sport in the U.S. where the people following it probably know way more than the lines makers, and then you can take advantage.
And the other thing that's kind of concerned me over the years is because MLS players make so little money in some cases that like they're actually like more of a target maybe for like, you know, doing shady stuff than other leagues. I'm
trying to think though, like, can you fix a soccer game? I mean, I guess you can sort of like let the ball go right past you. And but like you can't score at will. You'd have to let the other team score, but then the goalie sort of has to be in on it. Is goalie the right term? Goaltender?
Goalkeeper.
I know there's a goalkeeper, right? They'd have to be sort of in on it, maybe.
If you can get the goalkeeper and the referee, you can award a mysterious penalty in the 89th minute, then
Yeah, that would be good. We'll talk more soccer. Obviously, like I said, the Women's World Cup is coming up on June 7th. And I'm curious because you do work for Fox, so it's an interesting crossover, your SI/Fox. But you're hosting a new podcast for SI called Throwback. And I guess this is our foray into the vault, which I've always thought was sort of an untapped source for us at SI. It's kind of crazy. We have all this content, and we should definitely be doing more with it. So why don't you explain? Because I know the first one is a soccer one on the Women's World Cup team. And you're going to host all of the throwbacks, even the ones that are non-soccer?
No.
Okay.
No. So other SI writers will host different seasons.
Gotcha.
So this first season of Throwback is in connection with the Women's World Cup. It's about the first FIFA Women's World Cup, which actually happened way back in 1991. Long story short, a lot of people, even soccer people, seem to think that women's soccer only started in 1999 when the U.S. women won that tournament and filled the Rose Bowl.
What was the one where Brandi Chastain?
Correct.
That was
That's
99.
The one. See?
It's interesting, too, in this day and age, that that's still the...
Oh, yeah.
For the non-soccer fan, that's the image that is there, which in today's day and age, if that happened, there'd be like 5 million think pieces about, you know, how women have to get attention in sports and all that stuff.
So in 91, that was actually the first Women's World Cup, and it had a lot of the same figures that were part of the 99 tournament, like Mia Hamm, Michelle Akers, Brandi Chastain, Julie Foudy. But it was on Sports Channel America on tape delay, so nobody watched it.
Right.
And so nobody really even noticed. And so this podcast series goes back and looks at the origin stories of how the U.S. women's national soccer team got started in the mid-80s and how they got to be one of the best teams in the world in a short amount of time. And then also how the Women's World Cup as a tournament got started. We even got Sepp Blatter, who was part of that.
When was the first Women's World Cup tournament?
91
in
China, which is why it was on tape delay here and nobody watched it. But what is interesting to me, one of the things is like women's volleyball and basketball had world championships starting in the 1950s, but soccer is so far behind on like gender stuff that they didn't start until 1991.
So that's the reason why, because of the gender.
Yeah, I mean, they just didn't.
It's soccer, just yeah.
It's all men. That literally, like, FIFA and the national soccer associations, federations are run by men.
Right, and this is nothing to do with the politics. Currently, now there is a women's soccer league.
NWSL.
NWSL. And their games are on like Lifetime or something like that? Or?
They were until they ran into some hard times, which is a state of the game in club women's soccer. So they dissolved that relationship before the start of this current NWSL season. And so there's no national TV partner.
So the league is going. So the women's soccer league is going on. There's no national. I would assume they're on the internet probably streaming.
Yahoo Sports has all their games actually.
Okay. That's interesting that in this day and age with all these networks and, I mean, NBC Sports, CBS Sports, you would think these are networks that would need content and live. I mean, there's still nothing in sport. Forget whatever the sport you're talking about. There's still nothing better for a sports network than games, live games.
Live, right.
I mean, yes, you know, we just had this whole thing with the AFL, which was a debacle, or AAF. But the XFL now end up being on Fox and ESPN, which will be a different story then. So it's interesting that that league can't get on national TV with so many outlets.
And they've got all the top U.S. women stars in the league. It's a big year for them because all of their deals, except Nike just re-upped with them, except for that one, are up at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And so the success that the U.S. women's national team has had in getting viewership, which is significant, has not been replicated on the week-to-week league front.
Right.
And that's something they still have to figure out.
That's interesting. So back to the throwback. Give me, what was the most compelling storyline or thing that happened or the biggest nugget from that 91 team? What would be the hook to get a listener in?
I think part of it is just how little support these U.S. women's players, who are legends in their sports, Michelle Akers, Mia Hamm, Julie Foudy, Christine Lilly, like they were the best team in the world. They won the 91 Women's World Cup, and U.S. soccer paid them nothing. Nothing.
They literally
got
zero.
They got a per diem of $10 a day.
Oh my God, are you serious?
And that's it. And so
we get better per diem from SI if we go something.
Exactly. And so when the U.S. women's national team first started in the 80s, they weren't even given like women's uniforms. They were given hand-me-downs from U.S. soccer's men's boys teams.
And this was really just the U.S. though. The other competing teams, the other countries, they took care of their players?
No.
Okay. So it was no one really.
This is just women's soccer has really had to fight in so many different countries over the years. And in so many countries, they're still fighting for any decent treatment from their federations. So the U.S. women's team, they would stay in flea bag hotels. They would see U.S. soccer's boys' youth national teams getting better travel accommodations and treatment than they did. And it was something where eventually, when they started winning World Cups in the mid-90s, they started fighting and having labor deals and back and forth where they got some concessions. But at first, they made zero money in salary. And so once you were out of college, and some of those players were, there were players that were central figures on the World Cup winning team in 91 who had to retire at the age of 23 just because they couldn't make ends meet.
Right.
And so they became a coach. But you should never have to retire from your sport for those types of reasons.
Right.
And so U.S. soccer, it took several years before they even started paying anything in the way of bonuses, salary, things like that.
So the podcast takes you through basically then from start to the creation of the team, I guess, to the end of the tournament and all these struggles that they had to overcome. It's an interesting story for sure. You said some players couldn't had to stop playing because they couldn't make ends meet. How badly was that affecting the team? I mean, were they losing a lot of players? Were they losing key players? Were they able to patch things together?
You know, Title IX did have a really positive impact. Title IX 1972 legislation required that universities and colleges, if they provided athletic scholarships for men, had to give an equal amount to women. And that had a huge impact because from the mid-70s on, you had all of these varsity collegiate women's sports teams, including soccer teams, developing. And so there was at least a talent pool.
Right.
So what's interesting is that that's the talent pool that Akers and Mia Hamm and all those folks came out of. But there still wasn't a professional league. There wasn't a way to make it sustainable. And so in the early 90s and mid-90s, players would have to train on their own. You know, they'd have national team camps every once in a while. But they had to stay, world-class fit and in shape and all that stuff. And we kind of laugh at that now, but like these were the best players. Like they had to go through this. And then 1999 happened, that World Cup. But that didn't just happen overnight. That took years and years and years to even get to that point.
Right. The 99 World Cup, when the U.S. won, how much of an impact did that have, or did it not have as much? I mean, we think of that as an iconic moment. Was there a sustainable effect from that?
I mean, there was an effect in the sense that, this is one of the first big events I covered for Sports Illustrated. Mm-hmm. In those 3 weeks, it went from a story that we were covering, but it was like I think our preview issue was like a 4-page story, and they certainly weren't on the cover.
Right.
To when they won, not only being the cover of Sports Illustrated, but the cover of People, the cover of Time, that sort of thing, where this was like the cultural big moment of that summer of 99. They became the Sports People of the Year in Sports Illustrated. Now, in terms of stardom, Mia Hamm was a full-fledged superstar after that. They did create a league that started, I think it was a couple years later, 01. And, it had some buzz when it started, but they also found out that, as we talked about earlier here, that a league is a different thing week to week to try to sustain.
Right.
And they went through $100 million pretty quickly, and that league folded in 2003.
Yeah. Especially back then that's the surprising thing now, is back then it was harder to get on TV, and the TV money wasn't what it is now. Now, of course, everything too. I mean, when you talk about 99, the internet was barely up and running at that point. So it's a whole new, the internet coverage now of soccer is, I think the internet has helped soccer grow tremendously. I think that's a big, big factor in it.
And I think actually American soccer fans are pretty savvy. A lot of people in other parts of the world don't want to acknowledge that.
Right.
But, just the ability to see the best soccer from around the world, it's pretty easy here now.
I'm curious. Let's talk about you for a little bit, because you said you were covering that in 99. What year did you start at Sports Illustrated?
96.
Wow. That's really...
I don't think there's too many people with a longer tenure than me.
No, I started in 2000. So you started in 90. Wow, that's really old school. But you still look like you're like 25. That's why it's hard to believe. It's crazy.
Thank you.
And you do a podcast for SI, Planet Football. It's a weekly soccer podcast. You do SITV, Planet Football. You write. What do you like? Is writing still what you like to do best?
I like to do all of it, actually. Mm-hmm. I like the variety. Mm-hmm. Writing is something that I never want to totally stop doing,
right.
But I certainly do less of it than I used to. So it's about trying to find the right balance, I guess. I did a 5,000-word story on Claudio and Danielle Reyna, former U.S. men's and women's national team players, not long ago, who had four kids. Their oldest son tragically passed away from a brain tumor. Their second oldest son is the top prospect in U.S. men's soccer. Mm. And so there was a real story that they had never talked about. So that's the last major, you know, length story that I did, and that came out in December. And so, you know, what I've been doing since then in 2019 is focusing on this podcast series, which has taken a couple of months to do all the interviews and production. And we have three episodes of our half-hour video documentaries, which we call Exploring Planet Football on SITV, where I'll go for a week and a half to an interesting country soccer-wise and get a sense, it's half travel show, half soccer show, of what makes that country different or special.
Right.
So we just came out with, we had Iceland last year, we did Germany, just came out last week, where we went around and saw young U.S. men's national team players in Germany. We've got Japan coming out in a couple of weeks, and then Argentina a couple of weeks after that.
I'm curious, because the Planet Football podcast is similar to this SI Media podcast, and it's usually just like weekly. I think you have a guest, you do an interview, and then you went to the Throwback podcast, which was sort of a narrative podcast, and you're doing interviews that are going to be sort of in the can for a while before they're live, and it's a storytelling thing. Was it difficult to transition to that?
It was definitely different.
Yeah.
It was a very good experience for me to do it, just because it's so different than a weekly podcast, where generally my approach is, let's find someone interesting in the soccer world to interview for 30 minutes and we'll put that out there. And the metabolism's definitely different. But for me, it was just a really good experience to see how different it is to go about. We did, you know, more than a dozen interviews, lengthy interviews for this podcast series.
Did you book those yourself, or did you have help from, there's a production team on it?
I booked those myself. I've covered women's soccer since 96.
So it wasn't difficult for you to book those interviews?
No, not really. I mean, you still have to do it.
Right. I'm jealous, because booking a podcast is... hell on earth.
But yeah, I mean, like, you know, doing all those interviews, then working with a producer to do the scripts for the episodes and the whole process of editing that goes through. And then for me, simply getting my voice right in reading, doing the voiceovers for a scripted series was a new thing for me, for like that type of a podcast.
You didn't just talk like you're talking now?
You have a script. I mean, and it may sound
so you need
like
turn inflections,
but you
and...
also you like if I do a video essay for Fox Sports during the World Cup, they actually want me to read that script for that 2 or 3 minute video essay in a different way than I was asked to read the podcast series script. And I get why now.
It's interesting.
But like when I do I get into what my wife calls Fox voice.
Well, I was going to say, the worst thing is when you know someone is putting on the, like you hate, like this is where I come at it as a fan. Like you hate it, it's like, oh, and welcome to the SI Media podcast. Like that's the worst.
So
like it, well, all right.
So what I had to do, like typically what I'll do for a Fox video essay is I will underline words that I'm supposed to, you know, emphasize.
Right.
And then I was basically told to do the opposite of that for this podcast series, where, you know, have it sound natural and a little bit like you're just talking as we are now, but you're actually reading a script. And that, for me, doing it for the first time was harder than I expected, and I had I had to work at it.
So when the Women's World Cup begins June 7th, what's your situation at SI and Fox? So you're on Fox TV, I would assume, all the time, and you still have to do your SI stuff, right? You gotta is it tough to navigate?
It's not that hard, really, because everyone sort of understands Sports Illustrated is my top priority. Fox is my second priority, but there's not really conflicts.
Right.
So physically, I'll be on the ground for every U.S. women's game, wherever that is in France,
right,
the day of and day before. And then other than that, I'll be in the city where the Fox studio is. So that's Paris for most of it. They got this ridiculously nice studio right in front of the Eiffel Tower. The semis and the final are in Lyon, so I'll be there instead of Paris. But it's pretty straightforward.
This might be putting you on the spot since you work for Fox. So if you don't want to answer, you don't have to. But I'm just curious. I just thought of it when you were talking about Fox and soccer. Like, what did you make when they tried the Gus Johnson experiment? Did that turn you off as a soccer fan? Or
no. I actually, you know, got to know Gus fairly well. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really known him. When I covered college basketball through 2009,
right,
and I know Gus did a lot of college basketball, but he and I had never really, you know, connected or had a chance to. But I remember the 2013 Gold Cup. We were in Salt Lake City, and Gus was doing the calls for Fox, and I was doing sideline back then, which I don't do anymore. Gus had a feeling that U.S. soccer fans didn't like him because I guess he had seen stuff online. You know,
right,
Twitter was
right,
a thing. He
right,
read that stuff. And I said to him, I was like, look, every night before a U.S. national team game in the city, the fans, the American Outlaws, have a night before party. And there's a lot of them. They go to a bar. They come in from all over the country. And I said, Gus, go with me to the night before party. And he's like, they hate me. And I was like, no, believe me, they will love you. They will, you know, want to like give you soccer scarves and shirts and like things with the American Outlaws on it, and they'll want their pictures with you. And he finally reluctantly agreed to go, and he was a rock star. He loved it. And I think after that, he felt better about the hardcore U.S. fans.
Right.
Now he eventually didn't do soccer anymore and decided not to. But I don't know. I think I would suggest this. If you can ever get a show where you could get Gus Johnson or Dave O'Brien to talk to you about their soccer experiences, because Dave O'Brien, another tremendously accomplished announcer who did soccer for the 2006 World Cup.
Yeah, he got roasted too, I remember. Again, we're judging on Twitter, which is always one of those things, but I do remember that, seeing that.
I just think that would be it'd be fascinating to get both of them in the same place talking about their experiences, because I think they're so used to you know, being deservedly treated with so much respect by fans in other sports that I think it threw them a little bit that soccer people were a tough crowd.
Yeah, and I always thought, I guess I'm a little biased here because I do love Gus. And I had him on the podcast during the last college football season. I don't even think I got into the soccer stuff with him because I feel like I don't want to say he was set up to fail, because that's strong, but he had never done soccer before. Fox gets the rights, so of course, you know, I think Fox is the one who sort of should take the blame more than Gus for that, because I get it. They get soccer. They want to make a big deal, and they're using this iconic voice and announcer, but he's never called the sport before, and you know, it's just not easy to do it that way. So, and then obviously there was the backlash against Gus. You know, I guess the soccer fan felt he just wasn't the right fit for it. But if he's not the right fit for it, I mean, that's more on Fox than Gus. I mean, what's Gus supposed to do? He can't, you know, he's been calling games a certain way for all these years. And I also think, too, there was a lot of, I know people love the ESPN announcers, and then they lost it to Fox, and of course you always want what you can't have, so they missed that. Ian Dark, I guess, is the guy who all the fans want. Oh, no, who's like the huge play-by-play guy for you? Is it Ian Dark?
Well, Ian still does ESPN games for the national team. They brought John Champion in this year, who's very good. You know, it's interesting that people, I understand why they would focus on projects that maybe didn't go as well, or experiments like Gus in the end. But like Mike Tirico, for example, I thought, now granted, hosting a studio is not the same as broadcasting a 90-minute game play by play, but you know, Tirico did a pretty great job.
Yeah.
So it's tough though. I mean, I would also say like if you look at Fox right now, John Strong is a guy who is, you know, someone who's organic American, grew up with the sport in Portland, Oregon, one of the great soccer cities in America, and is, in my opinion, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. So,
well, that's
the culture produces those things.
Yeah,
now.
That's why I say the blame for the Gus soccer thing really goes on Fox, because then they quickly made the change after that. You know, when they realized the fans weren't warming up to Gus calling soccer, and then they brought in new people. And like you said, obviously now they have a strong crew, and it seems like most people are happy with that who watch the World Cup.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, it's one thing I learned doing Men's World Cup last year with Fox and Women's World Cup in 2015 is it's just such a giant event.
Yeah.
And so everything required to make it work well, it's like I could be a total, you know, if I'm with Sports Illustrated, I can be a lone wolf at one of these events, and I don't need help.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
It, like, whereas it's like, you know, being like on a, you know, like an aircraft carrier when you're with a TV group.
Yeah. Before we wrap it up, I'm just curious. So the U.S. women's team in this World Cup, are they favorites? Are they likely to win?
Yeah, the U.S. is favorites. Yeah. Defending champion. They've won 3 World Cups, more than any other country. However, they went out in the quarterfinals of the Olympics in 2016, and I would say there's more teams now, maybe a half dozen, that could actually win this Women's World Cup, and I think there's more than ever before that can win it.
So if the U.S. didn't win, is it a shock or would it be a minor surprise? Like, will the soccer fans here just be apoplectic if they don't win, or would it not be that shocking if they don't win?
The U.S. has been the gold standard for so long that just simply not winning, even if they lost in the final, right, would be viewed as this is a giant failure.
Okay. All right. So that's
they're the Brazil of women's soccer.
All right. All right. See, I like when that. Then I'll root for the U.S. to lose, and I want the anarchy of everyone getting all pissed off. When I don't watch a sport, that's what I root for. All right, I think I made it through pretty well with a soccer interview so far.
Is this your first one?
Pretty much. I mean, the thing is, I was thinking about when I was a little kid though. I remember watching the Cosmos,
yeah,
Giorgio Canalia,
sure,
and the. What was the Indoor League also called the MLS back then?
The MISL, and you probably watched
Shep Messing, the goalie. Arrows.
New York Arrows.
That was my team.
Steve Jungle, the lord of all indoors.
Yes. That I remember watching all that and being into all that.
That's cool.
But I was also like into,
you're in.
I also watched hockey when I was a kid, and I probably haven't watched that since the Rangers won the Cup in 94. So. You know, there's only so much time in the day. But you should definitely, I mean, I think whether you're a soccer fan or not, I mean, the story of the 91 World Cup team that's detailed on the Throwback podcast, there's been 2 episodes. Episode 3 comes out this Thursday, and there's 5 total, so you get the whole story in 5 episodes. I didn't know any of what you explained to me today about the money and just, you know, having to just work out on their own. It sounds crazy to me. So it's
wild.
Whether you're a soccer fan or not, there's obviously a very, very compelling story there.
So. I hope so. We've certainly put it together with the hope that you don't need to be some sort of soccer person to get something out of it.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. Enjoy France.
Thank you.
Glad we got to do this.
Appreciate it.
And that's Grant Wall. Check it out. Check him out on SI.com. Planet Football Podcast, Throwback Podcast, Exploring Planet Football video, and then, of course, Fox. I'll plug Fox even though they fired me a couple of years ago. That's okay. All right. Thanks, Grant. All right. That wraps up this edition of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My thanks to Chris Long and Grant Wall. Appreciate them coming on. And make sure you subscribe. Check out the archives. Recent interviews in there. Last week, we had Chad Finn and Brian Curtis on the podcast. Ian Rappaport, NFL Network Insider, a couple of weeks ago. Mike Breen, who's about to call the NBA Finals. You can hear from him 3 weeks ago. And Jim Nance recently as well. So dip into the archives, subscribe, rate, review. It all helps, and I appreciate it. And we'll see you next week on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.